From Montana to Georgia, New York to Oklahoma, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the partial government shutdown is dominating Washington politics. Adam Carrington from Hillsdale College is here to talk about the unstoppable force hitting the immovable object. Congressional Democrats are talking about raising the marginal tax rate to 70% and a possible federal gas tax hike. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story. One issue not getting much attention from Congress is the rising national debt. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Veronique Darugi from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. And the arguments against the border wall are intellectually dishonest and miss or misstate the point. So says Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The partial federal government shutdown has now become the longest such stoppage in history. Neither side appears willing or politically able to budge. Adam Carrington is an assistant professor of political science at Hillsdale College. He recently published an article on the issue. He joins us now to talk about how or if the partial shutdown could end. Adam, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Adam, the partial government shutdown, and I think we need to talk a little bit about the fact that it's only about a quarter of the federal government that we're talking about here, and everybody's wailing and moaning and rending their garments over that. But this partial government shutdown has gone on now for a record length of time. Is there the possibility that there is any sort of common ground that can be found here? Or, as you put it in your article, is this sort of a rock and a hard place type of situation?
For now, I think it's the latter. But I think if there is going to, and eventually there will have to be some resolution one way or another, I think the only way you're going to have mutual compromise is the common ground will have to be the opinion of the American people. The American people right now, I think, have not definitively blamed one side or the other, and it's really going to take one side needing to cave to that kind of pressure, which we haven't seen yet, and especially given the fierce determination from both bases, I think it's going to take something like that from the middle for a compromise to be forced to be reached or for one side to give in entirely.
The focus of this, Adam, is, of course, the border wall. But is that really just the tip of the iceberg? Are the president and Republicans and Democrats on the other side, is there a deeper divide over immigration, both legal and illegal, taking place here?
Absolutely. And I think it's right to say that really our debate should and will be about those broader questions, because in many ways, the border wall is both a symbol and a practical policy solution, but what you think of it comes out of the bigger question of what should be our immigration policies? How much should we try to protect our border and know who's coming in? And even though the Democratic Party has tried, and Speaker Pelosi and Senator Schumer have tried to argue that they're in favor of border security, there is a significant element of the Democratic Party that really wants to have minimal to no protection of our borders. And I think that that is a bigger question that we have to ask. What does it mean for us to be a country? What are our priorities? Who are we trying to protect and enrich the lives of? And I think that's the bigger underlying issue.
Also, at what point do other critical components of this overall issue, such as the fact that we have a virtually unimpeded flow of illegal drugs coming across the border that's killing hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Americans, and you have the illegal sex trade going on where we have folks who are bringing over captive individuals for that sex trade, not to mention the possibility of terrorists. Is any of this really entering into the consideration, Adam, that Congress is giving this issue? I know the president has talked about it, but what about Congress? Is there any talk at all?
I think at this point, given the way that the shutdown has gone, everything has been funneled into the question of the wall. But I think your point, if we're looking more at the good of the country, you have to see that there is a much broader set of issues, like what you mentioned. I would add on to it the need to actually enforce employers to only hire people who are here legally. The large number of illegal immigrants in the country that came here illegally and overstayed their visas. I think all of those issues show that not only do we have a security crisis, as the president said, but he added that we have a humanitarian crisis. And the wall is part of that question, but I think you're right that we really have to be asking comprehensively what are other things that need to be done as well, because I think one response the president could make to Democrats is, yeah, the border wall isn't a fix-all, but it needs to be part of more. If anything, you're showing that we need to do more than just the wall.
Is it possible, though, for Congress to grapple with this issue in the current crisis environment that is brought about by the fact that we do have this partial government shutdown, which doesn't appear to be impacting too many Americans yet, but ultimately, assumedly will? Is Congress able to function in that sort of an environment to really actually dig down deep and do policy work?
That points to a much also broader and deeper question. Why are we at this point? It's not just that we have a deep disagreement about immigration and the American people haven't, I think, definitively voted one party in and out to answer it, given the last two elections. But it's also that Congress is deeply dysfunctional. There's a book written recently that describes Congress as the broken branch. And I think that it would take a lot more time to divulge, but the way Congress runs itself makes it so it's more interested in scoring media points than actually crafting policy. They've given away a lot of their legislative power to bureaucrats and administrative agencies. And because of that, even when they want to do something, they've sort of lost their ability to craft and write good legislation. And I would just add one more example to that. Look how many problems there have been with the health care law, even from the perspective of supporters. It just shows that Congress, even when it knows it wants to do something, isn't very good at doing the very thing the Constitution gives it the power to do, which is legislate.
You are, of course, a professor of politics at Hillsdale College, and let's talk for a minute about the political implications of all of this. The president, of course, the border wall was a key component of his winning election campaign in 2016. If he gives in on this, that really undermines significantly his credibility with his base. What about the Democrats? Are they also in a position where they can't afford to lose their first big major battle with the president after taking control of the House?
Absolutely. I think in many ways these are mirror images of each other as far as the pure politics, because the Democrats just won a number of governorships, hundreds of state legislative seats, and the most seats in the House since Watergate. And for the Democratic Party, and for them to then lose their first big fight, I think would cause not a near revolt, but a full-on revolt. And I think you see, therefore, that the only way I think this is being undone is if one party finally decides that ticking off their base is the less of the bad options. And I don't think we're at that point at this point. So I think the shutdown is just going to continue going. But it shows that I think there's a civil war brewing within the Democratic Party that has only shown flickers of erupting, but will erupt as time goes on.
We have been talking with Adam Carrington, who is an assistant professor of politics at Hillsdale College. Adam, tell us a bit about Hillsdale and where folks can go to read your recent article on this subject.
My article is on Fox News Opinion. It is the title of it is "Will Pelosi or Trump Be the Unstoppable Force Over the Border Wall?" And if you'd like to know more about Hillsdale, Hillsdale is a small liberal arts school in southern Michigan. We're committed to the Judeo-Christian tradition, the Greco-Roman intellectual tradition, and also to being good citizens in the American government, to the Constitution, and the principles of the Declaration of Independence. And if you'd like to know more, hillsdale.edu, please, if you're considering college, it's a great place to go. And also, if you're wanting continuing education, we actually offer a series of online courses in politics, literature, history, to try to just help citizens be more educated and more able to function this great experiment in self-government we have in the United States.
Adam Carrington of Hillsdale College. Adam, thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Now, Andy keeps an eye on Congress, and things are pretty much at a standstill, but there are some issues perking below the surface. Andy, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
It's interesting. Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats took over control of Congress here a couple of weeks ago, Andy, and the government almost immediately shut down. What is this doing to plans that the Speaker had and the Democrat conference in the House had to actually start moving policy issues?
As you can tell just by turning on the TV or watching the news or reading the news sites, it's obvious that this shutdown is dominating Washington politics. The economy is a little uncertain. The trade policy is extremely uncertain. The Federal Reserve's policies are uncertain, but it's the shutdown that's dominating the headlines. And because of that, Nancy Pelosi can't really execute on her agenda. If she had her way, she would have entered into this new year as the new speaker with a clean slate where she could start cranking out the policy goals that her conference wants. The first being to start doing hearings on Trump, issuing subpoenas, trying to get down to the bottom of the Russia investigation and all those things that the Democrats are going to try and do. Plus, they also want to come out with a paradoxically, they want to clean up Washington and they want to come out with a bill that will be ethics reforms. But typically what those suggestions are just how Democrats can consolidate their power through campaign finance reforms and stifling First Amendment protections. So she can't do that when everybody's talking about the wall and everybody's talking about the shutdown. So even though the shutdown may seem like it's a tad bit in the Democrats' favor, they're not really excited about that because they aren't able to do what they want to do. So it's a nice conundrum that Pelosi is in, but eventually the shutdown is going to end and then they'll be able to start their agenda.
And part of that agenda, you have one surprisingly prominent member, or at least somewhat famous member of Congress, actually proposing a marginal tax rate of 70%. Doesn't that sound quite an overreach?
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the new very socialist Democrat freshman in the House from New York, she is very persuasive, or at least she's got a huge following on Twitter. Because she's young, she's got the attraction of the millennial crowd and a lot of younger Democrat voters. And she's calling on a 70% tax rate for people making over $10 million a year. Now, what she's trying to do is educate people on how great this is, but of course she doesn't mention how that's going to stifle economic growth. She likes to think that the 60s and the 70s were just banner years for equality because that's when tax rates were in the 90s and then lowered down to the 70s. But what she doesn't understand is that the tax base, meaning the amount of income that's subject to a 70% tax or a 90% tax, was very tiny. You could deduct all sorts of things in order to avoid paying 70% or 90% on your next marginal dollar. This was back during like the five martini lunches and expensing travel and expensing this and that. You could expense everything so that what you're left with is maybe 10 bucks that's subject to a tax over 70%. What she's proposing, though, is 70% tax on all your income above $10 million or above a certain amount. And that will definitely stifle economic growth because the people that make a significant amount of money are also the ones that are job creators. And so you're going to harm small businesses, large businesses, and the employees who work for them. So it's a really bad idea. Thankfully, it's not going to go anywhere. And I don't even think that Pelosi and House Democrats want to do anything with it.
Speaking of bad ideas, another tax proposal perking through the halls of Congress is an increase in gasoline taxes, supposedly to fund infrastructure projects. Is that something that we're likely going to see hit the spotlight here within the next few months?
So this requires a little bit of a backstory. The gas tax, the federal gas tax, has not been increased since the early 1990s, and that's a good thing. But Washington's appetite to spend on infrastructure, and mind you, spend it very inefficiently, has gone up. since that time. So naturally, the gas tax has not been able to pay for Congress's egregious appetite for spending. So naturally, politicians, rather than trying to tighten their belt, they want to increase the gas tax. And the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which loves to build roads and more roads and more roads, they're pushing for a gas tax increase, and they believe that there's bipartisan support in Congress for such a thing. I would point out a couple things for people who think that's a good idea. One is that Chuck Schumer, who's not to be confused as a fiscal conservative, hates the idea of increasing the gas tax, but his rationale is very good. He does not think that it's a good time to raise taxes on working families, which is what a gas tax increase would be. A gas tax increase is very regressive. It affects low-income and middle-income people far more than high-income people, and it would stifle economic growth, and it would hurt. And especially when the economy is kind of on shaky ground right now, this is not a good time to do that. So even though there may be some bipartisan support in Congress, my hope is that this isn't going anywhere simply because people recognize the gas tax increase for what it is, which is a really bad regressive tax.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, as always, a couple of words about the club.
Sure thing. The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C., but we have over 250,000 members from all across the country, from all walks of life, and we're united because we believe in economic freedom. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org, and if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Congress is most certainly divided among partisan lines, but there is also a divide over the impact of the rapidly growing national debt. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine discusses the issue with Veronique DeRugge from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Eric?
This month marked the beginning of a new session of Congress, and that means we once again have divided government. Democrats controlling the House of Representatives and Republicans in charge of the Senate. And of course, we've got President Donald Trump in the White House. The all-Republican government of the past 2 years did not do a whole lot to slow federal spending. In fact, the annual budget deficit and the national debt both reached new highs under the GOP's watch. So can divided government do any better? Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine, and you're listening to American Radio Journal. My guest today is Veronique DeRugge. She's a senior fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University and a frequent contributor both to Reason Magazine and right here on American Radio Journal. She's a friend of the show. Veronique, thanks so much for taking some time and being with us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Veronique's latest piece for Reason is titled, A Divided Congress Won't Slow Runaway Spending, and I guess that kind of gives away the big secret here, Veronique, but before we get into why divided government won't fix the budget mess, I wonder if you might just set the table for us a little bit. We're now looking at nearly $22 trillion in debt. That is just an astronomical number.
What is worth noting is that we have accumulated, and when I say we, is the member of Congress and the different administrations have accumulated more debt in the last 11 years than Uncle Sam has in the entire history of the U.S.
Yeah, that's right. It was around I want to say maybe $10.5 trillion when Obama took office in 2010. He obviously did quite a number to the national debt, and it's continued to rise under President Trump. Now we're approaching $22 trillion. It's just again, it's such a huge number.
It's fast growing. Now you can say there was a recession, there was all that stuff. But the truth of the matter is, like, usually in the past when you've had big emergencies like things like the Second World War, the debt would skyrocket, and as a share of GDP in nominal terms and everything, and then it would go down, slowly go down. And this downward trend is not really happening, and it won't be happening again, because unless we like do radical things like reforming entitlement spending, which are, I mean, obviously not entitlement. We call them entitlement, but they are the driver of our future debt. That's Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid.
As you point out, I think that's a really important point. One of the really stunning things about all this is that we've had a good decade. We've had a solid economic growth, no recessions, no real slowdowns. This is the time when you should be paying down the debt, but we're not doing that.
because the vast majority of the government spending is effectively, it's like close to 70% of our budget is actually three programs, so Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and interest on the debt. So unless, and these are on autopilot, right? And so unless we reform these, we're not going to be paying down that debt by shrinking to levels that are just socially right now unacceptable to most people.
We are talking with Veronique DeRuggi from the Mercatus Center about the national debt and the hopes that a divided Congress will take some steps to address it. Veronique, I want to ask whether Republicans' failure to grapple with these issues, with the debt and the deficit over the last few years, does that create an opening now for Democrats to just kind of wave away any concerns about government spending and say, hey, you know, we can spend whatever we want because obviously the Republicans, any objections they raise are somewhat empty at this point?
Well, first, it's worth noting that the failure of the Republican Party to control the spending goes way further back than 80 years. But the silver lining is that, in theory, like a divided government, a divided, and no matter how you cut it, but will lead to lower growth of spending increase. So it's not, spending is not going to be cut, but at least the growth of spending is going to go down. I would take this today with a grain of salt for the exact reasons that we talked about earlier on, which is when a bigger share of your budget is on such a big share. I mean, it's such a vast majority of the budget is on autopilot, right? The part that Congress is actually fighting over and has control over is small. So basically the slowdown in the growth rate is going to be tempered by that reality. But in theory, that's what we've seen. Divided Congress helps temper the growth of spending.
Yeah, maybe some small silver lining there. You know, I think back on the 1990s, Veronique, and I wonder about, that was the last time we had a balanced budget. We had divided government at the time. Look, obviously a lot has changed in politics since then, but there just doesn't seem to be any sort of focus on these issues now the way there was not all that long ago. What's really changed at the heart of all this?
Well, so everything has changed, not just the levels. So it means basically the size of the problem to tackle and the size of the solution to put in place. But it's also the culture in Washington. I think people have given up. Don't forget, in the 90s, right, President Clinton is the guy who said the era of big government is over. Do you imagine anyone saying this today? Do you imagine President Trump saying this? Do you imagine President Osorio Cortez, Warren, or whomever you put on the left saying this? Even if you get, you know, somewhat moderate Democrats, no one will be talking about the end of big government is over.
Yeah, Bill Clinton, shockingly not accurate with his claim that the era of big government was over. The era of big government, it seems, is here to stay, and it seems to only be getting bigger literally by the minute. That is unfortunately all the time that we have for today, though. Veronique DeRuggi from the Mercatus Center, thanks so much for taking some time and joining us here to talk about these very important issues.
You're very welcome.
And again, that is Veronique DeRuggi. She's a senior fellow at the Mercatus Center. Check out her work for Mercatus at mercatus.org and find her latest piece in Reason Magazine up at reason.com. That piece is titled A Divided Congress Won't Slow Runaway Spending. For Reason Magazine, I am Eric Boehm. Again, check us out online at reason.com, and you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Democrats are not making a good case against the wall, and President Trump has not argued effectively for it. So Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA sets the record straight on this American Radio Journal commentary.
The arguments against President Trump's border wall are intellectually dishonest. That is, they are fallacious. Here are a few types of fallacies that the president's political opponents use. First is the straw argument. This is the substitution of a fake argument for the actual argument made by an opponent, after which the fake argument is defeated. Gullible listeners typically fail to grasp the substitution. Here's a good example from Washington Post columnist Dana Milbank. Supporting the president's plan is to, quote, bet the United States' national security on the siege warfare technology of the ancient and medieval worlds, which is what a wall does, close quote. That's not what the president proposed, so the argument is fallacious. Another flawed argument concerns the terrorist threat. President Trump claims several thousand people from countries on the State Department's state sponsors of terrorism list were apprehended at the border, while supposedly professional news organizations like CBS dismiss the claim as false and say that only 15 or 16 terrorists were apprehended. Both statistics may well be true. One does not disprove the other. There are many migrants from terrorism-sponsoring countries, and there's a handful of suspected terrorists named on a list of known terrorists that were actually apprehended. To equate the two is to be dishonest and dissembling. CBS should be ashamed. Third, the reductio ad absurdum that even a 50-foot wall won't work because someone will come along with a 51-foot ladder and climb right over it. Newly elected Congressman Dan Crenshaw demolishes this rhetoric that a border wall of any kind is stupid by saying, quote, "I spent 10 years as a Navy SEAL, and people often say, Dan, you know better than anyone how ineffective a wall is. Actually, I know how effective walls are, even against skilled SEALs. Planning to scale a 30-foot barrier is a daunting challenge. Do you bring an enormous ladder all the way there? How do you get down from the top? Jump? Rappel? A few skilled and well-equipped people may figure it out, but the reality is that most will be deterred." On Wednesday, House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer said, "A wall in and of itself will not work." Well, no one has proposed a wall alone. Another fallacy. So here's a little common sense which has been anything but common in this debate. There are three elements to securing the border: physical infrastructure, technology, and manpower. All three must be deployed in such a way that they reinforce each other. A wall, fence, barrier, call it what you will, cannot do the job by itself, nor can manpower or technology. But an intelligent integration of all three into a well-designed plan can work, and a physical barrier is an essential part of such a plan. Look at the five dimensions of illegal immigration. The first, and by far the largest, is those who come here looking for work and a better way of life. The second is drug traffickers. The third is human traffickers, perhaps the most often forgotten dimension. The fourth is the public health concern. Many migrants have not had adequate health care and may not even know when they are carrying communicable diseases. Especially when epidemics rage, this can pose a real threat to the U.S. And finally, there's the national security dimension. Just what are people from Iran, Syria, Yemen, and others on the State Department list doing in Mexico in the first place, trying to break into the U.S.? Granted, few of them are likely to be actual terrorists posing an imminent threat, but it's clear that some are, because they were known by name and caught. So let's be honest in addressing this controversy. A physical barrier is a necessary element of addressing all five dimensions of illegal immigration, but it is the sole element in none of them. President Trump's opponents argue fallaciously against a wall, and President Trump argues ineffectively for it. It's no wonder that neither side is making progress. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country. They include our newest affiliate, KHLL-FM, in Alamogordo, New Mexico. Welcome to our new listeners in the land of enchantment. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.